Well, I'm not going to talk about all of the various conspiracy theories in existence. I'm not really going to talk about the deaths of JFK or Marilyn Monroe, or about crop circles, or about whether Yoko broke up the Beatles. None of these ideas would particularly concern us in any great depth as socialists, and they probably wouldn't warrant a talk at Marxism. But today there is a set of conspiracy theories which do warrant a response from Marxists. There are a set of conspiracy theories with some popularity that are, in fact, impinging on the work of socialists. And these are the conspiracy theories regarding the wars in the Middle East and, more broadly, the war on terror. Now, these require our attention because the war on terror is the central political question of our time. And also, as sad as it may seem, the conspiracy theory views of the war are probably the main competitor to Marxist views, that is, the anti-imperialist explanation of the war. Indeed, everywhere you turn nowadays, you'll see people swapping burnt DVDs or web addresses for so-called documentaries about how 9/11 was an inside job. Now, one problem is that these conspiracy theories can sometimes seem quite radical. They seemingly hold the powers that be, however defined, in contempt. It holds their media and their politicians in contempt. And these ideas can seem credible to people because the official explanations of the problems in the world are often totally dubious. I mean, we hear all the time people who support the existing system using humanitarian rhetoric. And yet this humanitarian rhetoric does not fit with the reality of brutality and exploitation and oppression. And we know that we're lied to by our rulers. I mean, think of weapons of mass destruction or children overboard. There is no shortage of genuine dishonesty coming from our rulers. And it has to be said that there have been quite a number of genuine conspiracies that have been carried out in history. Watergate and the Iran-Contra scandal are two very well-known and well-documented American examples. Perhaps even more relevant to the issue of 9/11 is there are examples where the US has gone to war using false stories. And, you know, I only have time to give you one example of this, and that is the fabled Gulf of Tonkin incident in August of 1964. This was when two US destroyers were attacked by the North Vietnamese Navy. And this incident was used as justification for Congress to give basically unlimited powers to the president, you know, to so-called fight communist aggression in Southeast Asia. The thing was that the incident never actually happened. And in 2005, the US National Security Agency issued a report where they basically had to admit this. They wrote, "It is not simply that there is a different story as to what happened that night, it is that no attack happened that night." There is, however, a difference between these events and the suggestions made about 9/11. It is one thing to tell a made-up story about an incident that supposedly happened in another country, but actually didn't. It is another thing to plan and carry out a massive terrorist attack in the heart of Manhattan and hope no one ever notices it was you. Now, I'm sure that the people who write the volumes of conspiracy material on the internet would probably dispute that they are, in fact, conspiracy theorists. They'll try and defend themselves from the sort of pejorative overtones of that label. And they would probably defend themselves by saying, well, weren't Woodward and Bernstein, the two journalists who first broke the Watergate scandal, weren't they just a pair of conspiracy theorists until it was, found out that they were actually right, that there was domestic political espionage going on in the United States and it was sanctioned by the president? Now, it's one thing to realise, and I think we must, that the ruling class can and does engage in all sorts of bastardry and dishonesty. And any allegations of that sort of behaviour, can be given due consideration, provided that the allegations plausibly fit the general pattern of ruling class behaviour and that they are backed up with pertinent evidence rather than half-truths and conjecture. But what I'm going to be talking about today is something different, markedly different, and that is conspiracism. Now, these are views that do not have a sound basis in fact, but they're actually based on a false view of the world. That is a complete misunderstanding of the forces involved in contemporary capitalism. And these views tend to, revolve around a more systematically conspiratorial analysis of the world, and often, though not always, contain a racial component. So I want to spend some time now defining out and theorising what we mean by conspiracy theories and conspiracism. And we should start by saying that there's actually nothing new about conspiracy theories, and historically speaking, they've not been primarily associated with the left. The right wing and the ruling class throughout history has frequently espoused conspiracy theories. For instance, there is a long history of ruling class-inspired conspiracy theories about the Jews. And I will be talking about anti-Semitism later on, as it unquestionably bears upon contemporary debates about the Middle East and about 9/11 and the theories about 9/11. But there are many other famous examples of ruling class-sponsored conspiracy theories. Look at the anti-communist witch hunts in the 1950s in America, what came to be known as McCarthyism. In this time, virtually every person with left-of-centre views in education, entertainment, the media, the public service, as well as thousands of rank-and-file blue-collar trade unionists were driven from their industries by the US government and compliant corporations. And all of this was based on the most spurious allegations that there were, you know, networks of tens of thousands of communist agents who were infiltrating American institutions in order to bring down democracy. This is an example of a conspiracy theory made state policy. And the Stalinist purges of the 1930s were really of a similar vein. Now, the Stalinists spoke of a world alliance between Trotskyism and fascism to sabotage the Russian economy, another gross conspiracy theory. However, the classic ruling class conspiracy theory is the one that you hear every time there is a strike or civil disturbance. The corporate media and the politicians always say this is the work of a small band of shady ringleaders. It's all the work of outside agitators. They're the ones who are responsible. So the system itself doesn't produce, you know, class conflicts. Instead, it's all just, you know, the work of this small manipulative band of conspirators that have, you know, somehow subverted the natural and peaceful state of class relations. That's the classic ruling class conspiracy theory. Now, you might ask, what is the relationship between these conspiracy theories that are propagated by the ruling class and the ideas about 9/11? Because most of the people who express those views tend to be oppositional to the existing government. And, you know, sometimes they would even have left-wing tendencies. Well, actually, conspiracism at its heart is based on some fundamental assumptions of ruling class ideology. I would argue that all conspiracy theories share this similar set of assumptions. Specifically, that conflicts and crises, such as wars and recessions, are brought about by the secretive work of a small group of conspirators, rather than being inherent to the system. And moreover, conspiracy theorists tend to view the mass of people as dupes, as clueless sheep, which is exactly what the ruling class thinks of us. Now, another way of understanding the nature of conspiracy theories is to consider them in terms of the long-running debate in sociology about agency and structure. Now, if you study sociology or social theory, you'll see that the relationship between structure and agency is a key theme. And what this refers to is the extent to which social structures, such as the class system, religion, state institutions and so on, to what extent do these shape and determine our behaviour? Or conversely, to what extent are we free as humans to act on our own will and our own desires? That is, to what extent can we exercise agency? Now, various trends of social thought answer these questions differently, and debates within the Marxist tradition often reflect different emphases on the relationship between agency and structure. But what distinguishes conspiracy theories from any serious social analysis is that they involve a complete collapse of structure. Social structures play no meaningful role because they're altogether negated by the work of some outside force, some force that has somehow burrowed its way into the system and has overtaken the functioning of society, without anyone else noticing it as well. And in terms of agency, well, it's quite clear that the only people in this scenario who are exercising agency are those small group of people involved in the conspiracy themselves. The rest of us have wool over our eyes. And that essentially defines a conspiracy theory. Now, to show you what I mean, let's look again at the idea that strikes are caused by outside agitators. Marxists, on the other hand, have class analysis. We can see that there is something inherent in the structural relationship between workers and bosses that can lead workers to take industrial action. namely that employers employ people to make a profit out of their labour, that bosses are driven by competition with other businesses to try and squeeze more profits out of workers by working us harder, by skimping on health and safety, making us work longer hours, all of those sorts of things. And this can lead workers to respond by forming unions and going on strike. Now, for us, the starting point then is the actual class structures of capitalism itself. Then we can look at the role of agency. And yes, agitators, or political activists, as we like to call ourselves, can play an important role in leading industrial action. We can help express the rage that workers feel, we can help give workers confidence, we can give advice on tactics, all of these sorts of things. But we'd actually be far less well placed to do any of that if we didn't understand that it was workers' own experiences under the structures of capitalism that makes strikes and industrial action possible in the first place. If we didn't understand that is what we're actually relating to. Now, in relation to explaining the war, we again have to look at the structures of the capitalist economic system. Marxists see war as inevitable and a structural part of the capitalist system. It is no coincidence that the spread of capitalism globally occurred precisely through wars of occupation. Capitalism came to Australia through a war of conquest to steal Aboriginal land. And it's also no coincidence that the most rich and powerful nation in the world today, the United States, has engaged in more military attacks on other countries since World War II than any other nation in world history. Now, to explain the prevalence of war under capitalism, Marxist theorists like Lenin, Bukharin, and Rosa Luxemburg developed the theory of imperialism. This explains how under developed capitalism, there is a convergence between the interests of large corporations and the states in which they're based. For instance, US corporations rely on the US state to pry open markets, to gain access to raw materials like oil, and to negotiate or impose favourable terms of trade. So capitalism is a competitive system, but this competition has long ceased to be simply between individual firms. Today there is a competition between powerful nation states, and that is basically what imperialism is. And military strength is the ultimate arbiter of the power of states. And this becomes clear when one considers how the victors of World War II were simply able to carve up most of the world into their spheres of influence. So, you know, Britain and the United States were able to, you know, to lay hold to, you know, Western Europe and so on, and, you know, the USSR got Eastern Europe and all of those sorts of things. It was as a result of their military conquests. And the theory of imperialism, I think, is essential to make sense of the wars that are going on today. And I want to explain why America has initiated the war on terror, why America went into Iraq, and why America has given unswerving support to the terrorist state of Israel. And these are questions that elsewhere have been given various explanations by conspiracy theorists. So let's start with global relations in the immediate post-war period. At this stage, the US was king of the world. The US economy accounted for a majority of global industrial output in its own right. The US was engaged in a Cold War against its rival, the number two power, the USSR. And to test its strength against the USSR, the American military embarked on a couple of major wars, firstly in Korea and then later in Vietnam. Now the Vietnam War resulted in 2 to 3 million deaths. And importantly, it also ended in a catastrophic defeat for the world's number one imperial power. And this defeat was world-changing. Enormous damage was done to American imperial prestige. It was a very traumatic event for the American ruling class. And one response to this defeat was a policy of trying to much more rule the world by proxy. The Nixon Doctrine was an acknowledgement that America couldn't afford to get embroiled in too many more Vietnams, you know, where it occupies whole countries. So it put more emphasis on the fostering of client regimes. And although Richard Nixon was a reputed anti-Semite, he recognised that Israel was a standout choice in this regard. Nixon became the first US president to make statements like Israel must maintain a margin of technological and military superiority over all of her Arab neighbours combined. And the US Treasury has provided Israel with the funds to be able to maintain that ever since. Now, the US does have other client regimes in the Middle East, like the Saudis, Mubarak's Egypt, and so on. But like Iran under the Shah or Egypt before Nasser, these regimes could well be subject to revolutionary overthrow. But within Israel, there was a regime with a population that was utterly immune to feelings of pan-Arab sympathy, a completely reliant attack dog for US imperialism in the oil-rich Middle East. And all in all, I think you'd have to say the US gets value for money out of Israel. It spends far less on supporting Israel than it does in maintaining its own military bases in the Middle East and in Europe. But I think the important point out of all of this is that in the vital relationship between the US and Israel, the world's superpower controls the client regime, not the other way around. So what were Afghanistan and Iraq about? Well, the US was keen to preclude the emergence of any potential rivals to its status as world hegemon. They were concerned about being challenged by an integrated Europe, a resurgent Russia, and most pressingly, by an ascendant China. In economic terms, the United States is not as far ahead as it once was. The proportion of world GDP that's accounted for by the American economy has been falling fairly steadily for decades now, and in the last 5 years it's fallen again from 30% to 25%. So the main advantage that America has as a nation is its unsurpassed military might. The United States now spends more money on arms than all of its rivals combined. But what is the point of this expense if you're not able to use it? So what the ruling class has been trying to do is kick the Vietnam syndrome, kick that reluctance that they've had so far, you know, since Vietnam, to engage in full-scale military invasions, ground invasions, and they really wanted to be able to implement regime change. And part of this is the fact that ruling by proxy has its own contradictions and problems. I think it's fair to say that often these client regimes become unreliable. I think that, you know, the United States, for instance, is quite frustrated with Musharraf in Pakistan and has been for a very long time, although they've not really figured out exactly what they want to do as an alternative. The same is true in relation to the Saudis. I don't like the fact that for decades they funded the PLO. They didn't like it when Saddam, who was, you know, previously one of their main allies in the Middle East, overstepped the mark and invaded Kuwait. That is an example of blowback. And to give you another example of blowback, Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden was from the second richest family in Saudi Arabia, and the CIA set him up in Afghanistan to fight, you know, their rivals, the Russians. America does that sort of thing all the time, by the way, and in fact they often start off funding the people who end up becoming their enemies. But that's imperialism for you. So, you know, the American ruling class decided that the international forces that they'd been relying on, you know, as their proxies, are basically a bunch of, you know, good-for-nothing, unreliable ne'er-do-wells, and they hope to break this cycle by being much more interventionist, to actually be able to go in and reshape the Middle East so they don't have to put up with these regimes that don't 100% toe the American line. And this was a strategy that was embraced by the entire American ruling class. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were supported by all of the political heavyweights, virtually, of both parties of American capitalism, both the Democrats and the Republicans. It was not just about, you know, the neoconservatives, the neocons. The neocons were simply the most vocal and unequivocal about the need to turn to this strategy. But the entire US ruling class was behind the so-called war on terror because it serves their interests. They benefit when America dominates. It's vital to see that it's the capitalist ruling class as a whole that is to blame, that the war is a product of their system. Unfortunately, there is a long-running legacy of ideas on the left that historically have diverted people's attention away from blaming the ruling class as such or as a whole. The communist parties, the old communist parties, had a version of this. They railed against the reactionary capitalists rather than the democratic ones. They railed against foreign or comprador capitalists and would, you know, support or look favourably upon, you know, the patriotic capitalists, this sort of thing. These analyses were at the heart of policies that were known as the Popular Front, if people are familiar with that term. So basically what it leads to are the politics of class collaboration, politics which say workers must get behind the nice capitalists to keep out, you know, the nasty capitalists. The problem with this strategy, and the reason why it always ends in disaster, is that the good capitalists are committed to the same nasty policies because they're committed to the same nasty system. And this dead-end strategy, one example in recent history of what this dead-end strategy produces, you know, this policy of lesser evilism, was in 2004 when the US anti-war movement got behind John Kerry for president. This guy's the richest man in Congress, and he actually wanted to send more troops to Iraq. So the anti-war movement had to be put on hold to campaign for this guy, because people believed that it was only Bush and the neocons that were responsible for the war. The key lesson is, you can't fight the system unless you actually realise that it is the system that's to blame. Now, one particularly dangerous alternative to blaming the system is blaming the Jews. You see, all the explanations for 9/11, for the Iraq War, and of course for US support for Israel have all been blamed on some quarters by the Jews, or on the supposed Jewish control of the US government. And if you're familiar with conspiracy theories about 9/11, they often point out that the attack was mysteriously, suspiciously carried out on Friday when, you know, Jews who work in the World Trade Center, for instance, were at home preparing for Shabbos, for the Jewish Sabbath. The implication is that, you know, the shady Zionists who orchestrated the 9/11 attacks only wanted to kill Gentiles. Fact is that it wasn't yet Shabbos when the plane hits. Most American Jews don't actually observe it anyway, and dozens of Jews were actually killed in that atrocity. But there is nothing new about making up spurious allegations about Jews whenever a country is experiencing problems. Anti-Semitism has always been peculiar amongst racisms, as it was largely based around conspiracy theories. Other racisms tended to denigrate their victims as being stupid and incapable and inferior. Most other racisms involved Europeans denigrating alien cultures, denigrating non-European cultures as being primitive, backward and inferior. But this wasn't really possible in the case of anti-Semitism, because its Jewish targets were themselves very much European, and in fact had disproportionately contributed to the achievements, such as they were, of European culture. Jews, you know, were frequently amongst the leading figures in political theory, philosophy, the natural sciences, and all of those sorts of things. Therefore, the idea that Jews were inherently inferior wouldn't fly. So anti-Jewish prejudice swings in the other direction. The Jews are painted as possessing the most incredible abilities. They were possessing a devilish cunning. In fact, according to the anti-Semites, they were able to take over the entire world and run the whole thing without anybody knowing about it. Now, of course, this is rubbish, but it was always handy for the rich. You know, at times of social and economic crisis, when people were open to rejecting the existing system, You could always rely on the ruling class to stir up anti-Semitism, to divert people's attention away from themselves and their system and onto the Jews. Now, one confusion that people might encounter is that the term anti-Semitism is bandied about today, to refer to people who aren't actually anti-Semites, but are in fact legitimate supporters of the Palestinian people and their struggle for national liberation. It is not anti-Semitic to oppose Israel. Indeed, we must oppose Israel and support the Palestinians and their national rights. But it is also important to realise that actual anti-Semitism does exist, and that conspiracy theories are one of the main ways of driving anti-Semitic prejudice. And you often hear the racists use euphemisms. For instance, those people who run the financial system. And I think you should be particularly wary when you hear people talk about Rothschild's bank. Now, these conspiracy theories about Jewish bankers, like many other types of conspiracy theories, can be mistaken in some way as being somehow anti-capitalist, because the targets in this case are bankers, who are obviously capitalists, and the same, you know, could be true of the people who talk about how the Masons run the world. You know, the Masons are rich and privileged. Don't you know their symbol is printed on the American dollar bill? Have you ever heard that? And if you happen to be on the other side of the sectarian divide, maybe you believe that it's the rich men in the Vatican who are plotting everything. And by the way, it is true that the Vatican, the Catholic Church, is one of the world's largest landowners. But actually, these theories are the opposite of anti-capitalism. What they're suggesting is precisely that capitalism itself is not at fault. It's just those rich Jews, or those rich Protestant Masonic Illuminati, or, you know, those wealthy cardinals. This is actually a classless view of the world. It gets in the road of seeing class essential. See, people feel that someone with wealth and power is destroying the world, but they're not realising that it's that entire class of people with wealth and power who are destroying the world. Now, why do people choose to blame just a section of the ruling class? I think one of the reasons is it reflects their own sense of powerlessness, that it can seem like an easier task when you say it's not the whole system we have to confront, it's just this tiny cabal of conspirators. So it can flow from people's sense of powerlessness, but it actually reinforces that sense of powerlessness. I think that that's one of the most corrosive aspects of conspiracy theories. In fact, one of the things I most dislike about the theories about 9/11 is that it makes US warmongers seem so remarkably capable and ingenious. The allegations make them not only bloodthirsty, which they undoubtedly are, but it makes them virtually omnipotent. And this is especially true of the most extreme versions of these theories, the ones whereby the planes didn't actually destroy the Twin Towers. It was all rigged in advance with explosives. The amount of mental and physical labour and resources that would have to be deployed to carry something like that out are enormous. And I'm certain that that would have leaked by now. I mean, various sorts of conspiracies and official secrets leak all the time. There are always whistleblowers. I mean, think, for instance, of the scandals about rendition. There are always people who... This stuff always leaks. Someone always would have come forward by now with real evidence. I mean, evidence of them doing it. You know, people keep these sorts of insurance policies, you know, that, you know, so they don't have to eventually go to hell. True. And what that therefore suggests is the US masterminds of the Twin Tower plane attack / bombing must have been so amazingly bright that they knew never to even raise this plan with anyone who could conceivably at any point blab about it. Now, only God herself would have that kind of knowledge about people's inner capabilities. And really, it's no surprise, therefore, as Robin Ramsey points out in his book about conspiracy theories, that people with a deep interest in conspiracy theories also tend to be fascinated with the supernatural, with mystic channels and so on. By ditching structure, they've invented mythical beings whose power radiates through everything in ways that most of us mere mortals can't even detect. But believe me, there is nothing divine or otherworldly about the neocons. In fact, there's nothing particularly intelligent about them. They are abject failures. Their war in the Middle East has hardly been a masterstroke of imperial grand strategy. It has been an unmitigated disaster. I think these conspiracy theories give these people far too much credit. And this is one of the problems I have with people as well who, you know, might agree with our analysis of imperialism but still think that, you know, that, oh, yeah, you know, it was about oil and power and US prestige and all those sorts of things, but I still reckon they did the 9/11 thing just to kick it off. I think it just gives these people too much power. I think it's a disempowering idea to think that they could actually do something like that and get away with it. Now, in terms of the theories themselves, I'm not going to have the time or the inclination, for that matter, to deal extensively with every suggestion made by these people, but I just want to give an example of the kind of methodology they use. So one bit of evidence is a quote from a flight instructor who had given flight lessons to one of the hijackers, who said, he's quoted as saying his student was a very poor pilot. And the suggestion is used to say, well, that's actually a very complex manoeuvre they did to turn the plane around and career it into the World Trade Center, and not something that a very poor pilot could do. Probably true. The thing they didn't say is that what the instructor actually said was that he was initially a very poor pilot when he took the lessons in 1997 to begin with, and in the intervening period got a commercial pilot's license, which they don't give out to very poor pilots. So that's just an example. And if you're willing to butcher the facts in these way and run a few dozen of these pieces of so-called evidence together, you can make anything sound plausible. You know, anyone with the time, some basic intelligence and video editing skills can do this quite easily. But why do people go to so much trouble? Well, I don't think it's actually that they're having a laugh. I think most of these people are genuine, that they actually believe it. They saw 9/11 happen, they already had a predisposition to conspiracy theories, and they decided at that time that it was an inside job. They then set about to uncover the facts, to be able to unveil the shocking truth. They didn't find any pertinent facts, so they got creative. Now, what to make of people like this? Well, my attitude is that people with a deep fascination and deep commitment to conspiracy theories are a waste of time. The people who write the hysterical books about 9/11 are not worth engaging with. They remind me of this guy in my neighbourhood who wears happy pants, a trucker cap, wheels around a trolley everywhere with homemade Jesus placards all around it. He's painted these placards and he's got them all in his front yard as well. They say, you know, Jesus is king, Jesus is saviour, repent before Jesus, blah, 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 blah. He looks utterly crazy. Now, imagine going up to him and trying to engage him from a different point of view. Right? You know, actually, I'm an atheist and, you know, so on. Or, oh, you know, I believe in the Prophet Muhammad or anything like that. What do you think the outcome is going to be of that conversation? You're not going to get very far. That said, there is a much, much broader category of people out there who are not hardened, committed adherents of conspiracy theories, but who think, for instance, there might be something, you know, possibly true about the ones about 9/11. In fact, millions of people, I think, worldwide are at least open to those explanations. We must remember that these are people who've lived through the unravelling of the lies about weapons of mass destruction. And they've seen the contempt that someone like George Bush has, not only for the people of Iraq who he's butchered in the hundreds of thousands, but also for his own people when he did not lift a finger to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. People have lived through that, and I think it's not surprising that a number of them now hear the conspiracy theories about 9/11 and think to themselves, I bet they would do something like that. Yep, I think they might have. This is not a surprising reaction. It's quite understandable. And in fact, I'd say there is almost something healthy in that distrust of the establishment, something healthy in that scepticism about the media and the politicians. That said, we do want to argue for the Marxist analysis of the war and our class analysis of society. This is very important. When Marx said that philosophers had interpreted the world in various ways, the point, however, is to change it, he wasn't saying that we shouldn't seriously try to interpret the world. What he was saying was that we need an interpretation of the world that helps us figure out how to change it. Now, Marxism can explain war. It can explain environmental destruction, why society is becoming more unequal, and why politicians lie. None of this is a surprise to us. We don't have to blame these problems on some tiny band of conspirators who have somehow subverted an otherwise pleasant capitalism. And we also realise that this system is crisis-prone, and it's a system that provokes resistance. And because it is a system that relies on our labour to function, we as workers have the power to bring the system down. This is our task, and to make it a reality, we actually have to understand the way society really works. And because conspiracy theories represent a false view of the world, they undermine our ability to change it. And that's what's wrong with conspiracy theories.